And welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan, Sudan, and the rest of the region this Friday, October 4th, 2024. A South Sudan court tries members of the organized forces accused of crimes, and one general says justice will be served.
The establishment of the court is not only timely, but necessary. It signifies our dedication to maintain high standard conduct and integrity among those entrusted with the protection of our nation.
And a United Nations human rights expert calls for immediate action in Khartoum amid reports of summary executions. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A joint special emergency court for organized forces has convened 9 years after it was first authorized to address complaints against organized forces by both civilians and fellow members. Several civilians have filed complaints accusing men in uniform of unprofessional behavior. The Deputy Inspector General of Police acknowledges that many members of the organized forces have not lived up to their mandate of protection in South Sudan. For VOA News, Dennis Lingagne reports from Juba.
The Joint Special Emergency Court was formed in 2015 to address complaints by civilians and even members of organized forces of misbehavior while on duty. On Friday, officials said the court will sit at the Central Equatoria State Police Headquarters with judges from the National Security Service, the South Sudan People's Defense Forces, and the South Sudan Police Service. Major General Sadiq Ismail Sadiq, the Director of Police Court, says the special court aims to address the growing need for justice in the country.
In recent years, we have recognized an increased need to address the complex approach, which is why the establishment of the court is not only timely, but necessary. It signifies our dedication to maintain high standard conduct and integrity among those entrusted with the protection of our nation.
Lieutenant General Thomas Jal Thomas, the Police Deputy Inspector General, says some members of the organized forces have not lived up to their mandate of protection.
This time, we have to be clear and we have to be realistic. Most of the crimes is either committed by somebody in uniform or is part of that crime. We have to admit this, because if you don't point at things the right way, things will not go.
Lu Rai Kong, the spokesperson of the South Sudan People's Defense Forces, has advised civilians to report any legal violation by a SSPDF member or police officer.
If you are a citizen of this country, you are residing in this country, even if you are a foreigner, and you have been aggrieved by those from the organized forces, this is the place where you will get a redress, where your problems will be heard and resolved in accordance with the law. And if there is a cross-cutting mandate, that will not spare anybody. You are from us, SSPDF, you will be held accountable in accordance to our code of conduct, rules and regulations. And the same way.
David Kumre is the spokesperson of the National Security Service. He says the service has received a number of complaints regarding allegations that authorities have been involved in land grabs and other misconduct.
We register a number of cases that sometimes we, the organized forces, we go and take somebody's land, and we receive a number of complaints in our offices. But today, my brother, my dear comrades, the law is going to take its course. I also want to send a warning to the national security officers, the NCOs. You commit the law against any civilian, you will be brought to this court.
Omara Joseph is the protection and advocacy officer at the South Sudan Human Rights Defenders Network. Joseph says this court, if utilized well, will render justice on a number of issues.
We know that some of the organized forces have not been living to the expectations, and that is why we have a lot of violations that have not been accounted for. And if this court is established, I'm quite sure some of these violations against human rights, against the civil population, will definitely be reduced.
According to a 2024 Human Rights Watch report, South Sudan continues to face a dire human rights and humanitarian crisis. It notes that conflict between government officials, opposing forces, and their respective allied militias continues. A United Nations Human Rights Body highlighted the impunity that is enjoyed by senior South Sudan Army, police, and national security officials responsible for serious human rights violations. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Lingagne reporting from Juba.
The designated expert on Sudan of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights today called for urgent protection of civilians in wake of disturbing reports of summary executions in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. UN human rights expert Radouan Nusser says the Sudanese Armed Forces, or SAF, and the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, and their respective allied armed militias need to take immediate steps to ensure that civilians are protected in the greater Khartoum area amid an escalation of hostilities. Since late September, the SAF launched a major offensive to retake areas under the control of the RSF in Greater Khartoum. The SAF reportedly launched airstrikes and artillery shelling targeting RSF positions, focusing on key entry points to Khartoum, including the Halfaya Bridge, according to the UN. Airstrikes and shelling reportedly resulted in dozens of civilian casualties and extensive damage to civilian infrastructure. Nusser warns that the ongoing battle in the city, in his words, echoes the horror of the initial period of the conflict in April 2023 and could result in a large number of civilian casualties among people trapped next to strategic locations. He says the fighting could also result in serious human rights violations and massive displacement. Nusser expressed alarm at reports of the summary execution of dozens of young men reportedly from the Halfaya neighborhood of North Khartoum, allegedly by the SAF and its allied militias. Reports indicate that up to 70 young men may have been killed in the past few days. Nusser says videos circulating online have shown the bodies of young men purportedly killed based on suspicion of affiliation or collaboration with the RSF. He calls the killings beyond despicable and contravenes all human rights norms and standards. Nusser urged all parties to the conflict to respect their obligations under international humanitarian and human rights law, including their obligation to ensure that no one be arbitrarily deprived of life. So far, neither side has shown a willingness to respect international law. Talks aimed at reaching a ceasefire in Sudan have gone nowhere. Tunisian politician Ayachi Zamel, a former lawmaker and a candidate in Tunisia's October 6th presidential election, has been sentenced to 12 years in jail. The frontrunner is incumbent President Kais Saied, who was elected in 2019 and later dissolved parliament, replacing it with a legislature with limited powers. A third candidate is former parliamentarian Zuhair Maizoui, who was also a supporter of Kais Saied. Ahead of the vote, Tunisia's electoral authority had rejected the bids of some 14 hopefuls. Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, discussed the challenges facing fair elections in Tunisia with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
I think it's been clear from the start that Kais Saied would do whatever it takes to manipulate the legal environment to ensure his victory. But what we've seen is he's taken this really to the extreme by eliminating any real opposition. And on the one hand, what we've seen is, you know, he's acting similar to a lot of other autocrats in the region who try to engineer the election in advance so that the scales are sort of weighted in their favor. But what we normally see is some sort of facade or some sort of semblance of a real contest. And if you look at what we just saw in Algeria a few weeks ago, where President Tebboune was running for re-election, and he at least allowed real opposition candidates, including an Islamist candidate, to run, even though he clearly knew he would win. But in Tunisia, Kais Saied has left nothing to chance. And I think what we're seeing is both that he just has no regard for democracy, but also we're seeing his own paranoia come out and that he doesn't trust the Tunisian people to vote for him. He really has to ensure that they have no other option.
Ahead of the vote, Tunisia's electoral authority, ISIE, had rejected the bids of some 14 hopefuls. Human Rights Watch accused ISIE of skewing the ballot in favor of Saied, saying holding elections amid such repression makes a mockery of Tunisians' right to participate in free and fair elections. How would this political environment impact the turnout of voters?
I think that this really clear and obvious electoral manipulation is going to turn off many voters. What we've seen under Saied is that each of the elections that have been held under him had very, very low turnout. You know, in the legislative elections, there was just 11% turnout, which is one of the lowest in legislative elections in the world. And so I think in this current contest, the Tunisians understand they don't have a choice. And so why would they bother to show up at the polls? But it's what's not clear, I think, at this point is what role the opposition is going to take in that will it enact a formal boycott or some sort of spoiled ballot initiative? Or are people just going to stay home out of sort of boredom or just disinterest in the election? I think either way, the turnout's going to likely be very, very low.
A majority of Tunisian parliament members approved a bill on Friday to transfer election oversight powers from the Independent Administrative Court to the country's General Appeals Court. This bill sparked public protests opposing the law, characterizing it as a blow to the foundations of the electoral system and aim to strip the administrative judiciary of its exclusive role. Can you explain why this law is a blow to the Tunisian electoral system?
This is, I think, one of the more egregious and frankly shocking developments in what has been a really unconventional electoral period. You know, the administrative court was attempting to do its job and serve as an apolitical body by adjudicating various cases. But when they decided to reinstate three of the potential presidential candidates who had been disqualified by the ISIE, Saeed began to see them as a threat and sought to undermine them. And stripping the court of its power just days before the election, you know, when you add that on top of Zamel's sentence, I think this is sufficient evidence to anyone watching that this election is neither free nor fair.
That is Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She was speaking with my colleague, Mohammed El-Shenawi. Here in the United States, more than 70% of likely voters worry about politically motivated violence after the November 5th election, according to a recent poll. One U.S. expert on extremism I spoke to recently says such violence often involves people who have been radicalized online.
A poll by Quinnipiac University in the U.S. state of Connecticut found that 73% of likely politically motivated violence following the outcome of the presidential election. Last month, President Joe Biden said he is not confident a peaceful transfer of power would happen if former President Donald Trump loses the election. Trump and his allies have repeatedly said widespread election fraud is possible, but election experts and law enforcement agencies around the country say there is no evidence backing that allegation. In the weeks after the 2020 election, Trump did not accept that he lost to Biden, insisting the vote was rigged and stolen. His claims culminated in violence at the Capitol on January 6, 2021, when his supporters stormed the complex to try to stop the certification of Biden's victory. John Lewis is a research fellow at the Program on Extremism at George Washington University here in Washington, where he studies domestic terrorism. He says people involved in political violence often are indoctrinated online.
When we look at the extremism landscape and the threats to election workers, threats at polling places, oftentimes it's not groups, right? It's not domestic violent extremist groups that we would think of like necessarily the Proud Boys or the Oath Keepers or similar organizations. Oftentimes it's these networks, right? It's individual actors who are frequently radicalized online and who are motivated by this culture war rhetoric.
To minimize the potential for violence surrounding the elections, Lewis says everyone needs to take the temperature down, as individuals across the ideological spectrum have normalized what he calls the we versus them language.
And when we talk about the threats to election officials, threats to, you know, individuals in these spaces, oftentimes it is coming from some form of anti-government extremist, right? Someone who has been told time and time again that the government is illegitimate or the government is tyrannical or is coming for them in some way. And so I think when you have this messaging that is coming out of mainstream spaces, you know, members of Congress, elected officials at the state and local level, that matters.
The two men suspected in two assassination attempts of the presidential Republican candidate, former President Donald Trump, were not known to be affiliated with any extremist organization, nor particularly involved in politics. Federal investigators in both cases have not yet revealed what they think motivated the attacks. Around the country, state and local election officials tried to head off election misinformation and possible violence by providing reliable information. On the website for Cuyahoga County in the Midwestern state of Ohio, people can check an Election Integrity Center and Rumor Control Center. Tony Callagher is the deputy director of the Cuyahoga County Board of Elections.
Anytime there's an attempted assassination on a current or former president, obviously, you know, disturbing. But I would say as far as Cuyahoga County is concerned, you know, we're aware and, you know, we're mindful of, you know, the mail that comes in, and we're making preparations with, as we always do, with the Sheriff's Department and security that we have here at the Board of Elections.
Gallagher says his county has improved security at polling places, comparing the situation with having insurance, saying it's something you hope you'll never need, but it's better to be prepared ahead of time. The risk assessment varies from location to location. Devin Rhodes, director of the Snyder County Board of Elections in the state of Pennsylvania, says in his rural community, everyone knows everyone else, so there is little need to step up security.
When you actually go to a polling location, it's almost like a class reunion because everybody kind of knows each other. The poll workers know the voters know the poll workers, or if they don't know them directly, they certainly know family members of each.
The Federal Bureau of Investigation and other law enforcement agencies have said they have beefed up efforts to prevent election violence and politically motivated attacks on officials, judges, and election workers. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, Chinese and Western consumers are now moving into electrical vehicles if they haven't done so already. But that's not the case in Africa. Find out more when we come back. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. While China and the West have been pushing for more electric vehicles on the road, gas-powered cars still dominate in Africa. Chinese automakers are tapping into the South African car market, the largest on the continent, with prices so attractive that dealers say existing brands risk being pushed to the curb. Kate Bartlett has the details from Johannesburg.
Ross Gray is looking for a gas-powered SUV that suits his young family and a job that involves a lot of work on building sites.
The reason I'm looking at something like this, the Chinese vehicles, is because, first of all, the price, it's a lot cheaper than your big brands.
The average Chinese SUV is about half the price of some of the more established brands from other countries. Ralph Heibner, Bike's regional sales manager, says the prices of these Chinese gas-powered cars draw customers to his dealership.
Not cheap in the sense that they're dumping product in South Africa, but affordable in terms of monthly payment, because for the South African consumer, it's not about the full price of the vehicle, but what am I paying on a monthly basis? That has to do with economics.
Chinese brands have become serious contenders in South Africa's auto industry, says Mari Magia, salesperson for another Chinese brand called Haval.
I do know a few that are closing down because of the Chinese dealerships that are opening up. We're booming, if I can say that.
In the past, many South African consumers were wary of the quality of Chinese-made vehicles. But buying habits may be changing. Gray says he's more comfortable with Chinese-made quality nowadays. There's also another, more local reason for considering a Chinese-made SUV. Gray's last car, a pricier Toyota Hilux, was stolen.
Being South Africa, the Chinese vehicles are not on the stolen list like the big brands are.
While only about one-third of South Africans own a vehicle, it is the largest car market on the continent. Ford, Toyota, Volkswagen, and Mercedes have manufacturing plants in the country producing vehicles for export or for the local market. The newest Chinese players in the car market are disrupting the industry here, says Michael Mabasa, head of South Africa's NAMSA, the Automotive Business Council.
In the last 5 years, we've seen an introduction of some very interesting brands that are coming into the country from China. And those brands have grown in the market and they've surpassed, in fact, many of our traditional brands that we have in the country.
Mabasa says there has been a 200% increase of Chinese gas-powered car brands coming into the country between 2019 and 2023. The growing popularity of Chinese brands doesn't mean there aren't bumps in the road. In 2018, Bike opened a manufacturing plant in the Eastern Cape, but production stalled, reportedly due to the pandemic, labor disputes, and a lack of brand awareness.
They're still in a setting up phase. They've obviously experienced some hiccups in getting that particular plant off the ground.
Bikes, business detours aside, President Cyril Ramaphosa is looking down the road to a greener future, courting more investments from China and urging electric car maker BYD to set up shop in South Africa. With Sahir Kasim, Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
The war unleashed by Israel after the Hamas-led attack on Israel October 7th of last year has ravaged not only the people of Gaza, but also taken a toll on neighboring Egypt, keeping its government officials busy and straining its economy, while also bringing some benefits. Edward Uranian has this report for VOA from Cairo.
The Gaza conflict has spawned countless hours of diplomatic activity and a long list of visits by envoys from several countries in the year since conflict broke out in Gaza on October 7, 2023. Mediation efforts have been unsuccessful, but the conflict has kept diplomats busy with meetings of the Cairo-based Arab League and consultations involving Egypt, Qatar, and the U.S., among others. Saeed Sadiq, professor of peace studies and human rights at the Egypt-Japan University in Alexandria, tells VOA Egypt has been one of the key players in mediation efforts between Israel and Hamas. He says its efforts have been successful at times and unsuccessful at others.
Politically, it highlighted the Egyptian role in being a moderating force in the Middle East. In all the negotiations that took place later on between Hamas and Israel, they always needed a mediator, and it was Egypt and Qatar and the United States, and they all played a role in that, and sometimes they succeeded and sometimes they failed.
The head of Egyptian intelligence, Abbas Kamel, spent many hours mediating between Israel and Hamas, as has U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Qatar's Foreign Minister Mohammed bin Abdurrahman bin Jassim Al Thani. Economically, the Gaza conflict has caused serious damage to the Egyptian economy, but it has also brought benefits, as Washington-based Middle East analyst Paul Sullivan points out.
Economically, Egypt is being squeezed between many rocks and many hard places with a few positive bits of light. The positive bits include money flows from the GCC, the IMF, the World Bank, and others to make sure Egypt gets a bit more stabilized economically.
Saeed Sadiq and Paul Sullivan both agree the Egyptian economy suffered setbacks from the side effects of the Gaza conflict, including a massive drop in revenue from the Suez Canal, one of the Egyptian government's primary sources of income. Sadiq tells VOA Egyptian government revenues from the canal are down substantially.
The Houthi in Yemen blocked navigation, safe navigation across the Red Sea, and that, of course, affected the Suez Canal that used to bring Egypt about $10 billion. Now we are getting only $3 billion, so there's a big loss of 70%.
Sullivan says Egypt is not only suffering from a loss of revenue from the Suez Canal due to ships going around the Horn of Africa to get to their destinations, but it is also in danger of a natural gas shortage if Israel were to cut off its gas exports to Egypt. That would force the Egyptian government to import natural gas at considerably higher prices. Egyptians are already reeling. The government has raised the prices of petroleum and natural gas twice this year by as much as 15% each time. Egypt's overall inflation rate has hit 25%, with analysts blaming the jump largely on the war in Gaza. Tourism revenues are also down due to the Gaza conflict, and some Western countries have warned their citizens not to travel to Egypt or other Middle Eastern countries. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
It's that time of the week when we hear from you, our listeners, about what's happening in the news and your thoughts about our coverage. But first, we start with an audio comment from one of our listeners, and you'll hear the rest of the comments read by my colleague, Jackson Mvunganye.
This is Peter Goshanyang Mujangdul in Jongle State, town Obor. Dear John, the decision made by Uganda People Defend Post to deploy forces along Juba-Nimule Highway is a good move. But the question remains, The South Sudan People Defense Force not capable of protecting commuters along that route, because to me, I see it as another branded encroachment to our territory.
Hello, VOA South Sudan in Focus. I'm Peterson in Kajokeji County in Central Equatorial State. I'm really urging the U.S. government to stop the ongoing war in the Middle East. Otherwise, innocent civilians, especially women and children, are suffering. As always, elders say, when two elephants are fighting, the grass always suffers. And indeed, the civilians are the ones to suffer, not the army. Hi, I'm Peter Gok Anyang Majongdul in Jonglei capital, Bor. The appointment of General Akol Kor Kok as governor of Warap State will definitely bring peace and stability to the state and reduce crimes related to cattle raiding within Warap and with neighboring states like Unity and Lake States. I urge the appointed governor, Mr. Cook, to join hands with General Rin Twenye for a peaceful Greater Bahal El Ghazar region. Amading Malwal Alwong in Juba. UPDF thinks our military defense is weakened by the economic meltdown and political instabilities, not knowing our soldiers can fight sacrificially, even with an empty stomach, like the way we fought against the Khartoum oppressive regime. But Santino Dengwall addressed them softly in a muted diplomatic voice instead of militarism. Hi, I'm James Luel Majok from Unity State, Bentiu. I'm appealing to South Sudan government to really focus on peace implementation and management of other problems that will affect the implementation of the peace agreement. Hello, VOA. I'm Akol Mark Deng from Nimule Town. I had very good news from Mr. President. Congratulations to General Akol Kor Kok for his appointment as governor of Warap State at a very difficult time when the state and its citizens need total security, peace and stability, and above all, infrastructure development. Mr. President appointed you at a very difficult time because he believed in your loyalty, discipline, and hard work you demonstrated in making the national security a great institution that protects the national interest of the people of South Sudan. We wish you the best and good luck on your new assignment. Hello, I am Antonio Magwek Machar in Marial Walpayam. The intercommunal conflicts that's intensifying both in Tonj North and East counties is beyond description, as innocent children and women are being killed, properties looted, and houses are being burnt, including health facilities. It's such a pitch of inhuman hellish brutality and the horror of the degeneracy of human nature. I appeal to the government to silence the guns by disarming the civilians. Thanks. Good evening, John Tanza. I'm Peter Ajak Ayom from Bor Town, Jonglei State. What is really happening in this country? On Sunday, 29th of September, 2024, a car of Minister of Parliamentary Affairs traveling fell into an ambush along Juba Bor Road by unknown gunmen, and thanks to God, no one got injured. Many road ambushes are happening. It is last when the bus traveling from Juba to Kampala, Uganda, fell into the hands of unknown gunmen of dozens of persons who were killed and many others got scattered into the bushes. Here, I am urging the government to set patrol to be escorting cars along the two ways. Otherwise, citizens are finishing themselves for nothing.
And that audio was recorded by VOA's Jackson Mvunganyi. Thanks, Jackson. That wraps it up for us this Friday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you somehow missed this broadcast, just head on over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Guda Miza by Radio and Weasel featuring B2Z. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Peter Hundley, and producer, Kwame Afori, thanks for joining us. We hope you have a great weekend, and we'll see you back here next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Negalira mu nyumba ya mainja na komerera misumari. Ah, your love is so original. So original, so original. Yo love you, cola, cola, sigilo. Sigilo, sigilo. Omu kwano kunga guda meza. Ama benzi kunga kata wanya. I'm
body tattoo your name on my face. You're so tempting. Bring them close, I cough, like a smile on my face. Like a tuba cueva, pemures. Sing my bandit, get up on